A Matter of Spirit is a quarterly publication of the Intercommunity Peace and Justice Center. Winter, 2015, issue on nonviolence.
Unlocking a Nonviolent Future by Michael Nagler, Ph.D. Derek Oakley and Andres Gutierrez ducked into a hut where they found 5 women and 9 children also hiding. On April 17, 2014, gunmen invaded and started shooting unarmed men, women, and children in the Protection of Civilians, POC, compound of the United Nations mission in South Sudan. They eventually killed at least 58 people, most of them internally displaced people, IDPs, of the Nuer ethnic group who had been staying in the POC since the civil war in South Sudan erupted in December 2013. Soon enough, the militia burst into their hut, armed with assault weapons, axes, and sticks. Somewhat startled to find 2 non-Sudanese there, they roughly ordered them out. But Derek and Andres were well-trained. Glancing at one another, they turned to the gunmen and calmly explained that they were humanitarian workers and would not leave without the others, who were, anyhow, innocent women and children who had nothing to do with the war. Apparently unmoved at first, the militia ordered them to leave 3 times, but Derek and Andres did not budge. In the end, the militia left and the women and children were all saved. Who were these 2 men and what were they doing in one of the world's most violent conflicts? And how did they survive their brush with death? Derek and Andres were respectively International Protection Officer and Team Leader for the Nonviolent Peace Force, NP, in South Sudan. NP is the largest of some 40 non-governmental organizations worldwide that are carrying out what are called Unarmed Civilian Peacekeeping, UCP, institutionalizing an ancient practice that Mahatma Gandhi envisioned as a way to protect communities from communal violence, and now seems to some, including the present author, to be a nonviolent answer to war. As Derek explains, quote, "If we had had weapons, we would not be alive today," unquote, and neither would the women and children. Quote, "Andres and I survived unharmed through a combination of nonviolent training methods focused on strategy in dealing with nonviolent conflict, with violent conflict and ethnic tensions." UCP represents one of 5 qualitative changes, growth points, that have emerged in the development of nonviolence worldwide in the years since Gandhi and King. They are, 1, new institutions. Along with more formal institutions such as the International Criminal Court, arguably nonviolent in that it removes impunity from certain very violent crimes, and legal protocols like the, quote, right to protect, unquote, civil society organizations like UCP have come onto the world stage to reduce and forestall conflict by creative nonviolent means. There are some 40 UCP groups operating worldwide, which can be divided into 3 types. Local nonviolent vigilante groups like Chicago's Interrupters, or the Orange Berets that patrol New York subways. Domestic teams like Meta Peace Team that keep the peace at potentially volatile events, often more effectively than and much appreciated by police forces. And international cross-border peace teams like NP. These new institutions also represent the important shift in the logic of organizations from a top-down, hierarchical model of the typical for-profit corporation to more organic and democratic forms. This has been beautifully brought out by Ori Braffman and Rod Beckstrom in The Starfish and Spider, The Unstoppable Power of Leaderless Organizations. Since the essence of nonviolence is rehumanization, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, we must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented civilization to a person-oriented civilization, end quote. This shift toward a more human-centered vision of organizing is the key structural feature of a possible nonviolent world. 2. Learning. The peace movement, or in Kenneth Boulding's insightful phrase, the worldwide, quote, movement toward peace, unquote, has traditionally been plagued by discontinuity. Every event, every opportunity that crops up in the course of events takes participants unawares, and they must, quote, reinvent the wheel, unquote, with all the weaknesses and errors incident to that kind of operation. In sharp contrast to the systematic, diligent learning that goes on in the war system. Today, taking advantage of the increases in global communication and travel, activists have been more concerned to share, quote, best practices, unquote, with those who find themselves in similar situations. Student leaders from the successful overthrow of President Milosevic in Serbia, for example, were on hand at Tahrir Square. They created the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, CANVAS, to carry on this vital work. 3. New science. What is now called classical science, the materialist paradigm of life as random, deterministic, and essentially meaningless, is an integral part of the world of violence and destruction from which we are trying to emerge. In the last 30 or so years, an undeniable paradigm shift has happened across all scientific disciplines, which should have profound and helpful alternative impacts on the search for a nonviolent future. Quote, mirror neurons, unquote, studies on empathy, a new vision of evolution. The story is too rich to be detailed here, but every peace actor should be well versed in it. Gandhi, who seized on the work of N.K. Bose on the consciousness of plants to buttress his arguments for nonviolence, would be making superb use of the new science today. Since this new science resoundingly supports the inheritance of human wisdom, we now have a powerful consensus about reality, whether we look at the outside or the inside worlds, through science or spiritual discovery, that point to nonviolence as not only possible, but the fulfillment of our destiny. 4. New actors. Gandhi began his work among relatively enfranchised free Indians, and a critical boost to his Satyagraha campaign happened when two new groups were drawn in, laborers and women. Similarly today, two traditionally marginalized groups are increasingly empowered, organized, and engaged. Women, probably the most important, and indigenous people, who are increasingly threatened by corporate attacks on their lifestyles, have found ways to mount successful nonviolent resistance, especially in North and South America. At least one regular organization, Via Campesina, has helped them gain visibility and effectiveness without sacrificing their traditional lifestyle. And we have seen unprecedented collaborations among people who were all but unaware of one another's existence, like Native Americans in the territorial United States and Mayan Indians in southern Mexico. 5. Peace science. Along with the great shift in hard sciences, scholarly research has begun to acknowledge nonviolence as a field, or at least a phenomenon. There is now an extremely influential study, Why Civil Resistance Works, by Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan, 2012, showing that, quote, transitions to democracy, unquote, that are free from violence, parenthesis, not the same as nonviolent in principle, which is still quite rare for large movements, close parenthesis, are twice as effective as violent ones in one-third the time. When Professor Chenoweth, who at first did not believe in nonviolence, went to look up the research on the relative effectiveness of violent and nonviolent resistance movements, she found none. People had been arguing whether nonviolence works since time immemorial, but no one thought or dared to look at the evidence. Nor is this unusual in the world of nonviolence. Franz de Waal, decades earlier, found that no research had been done on the resolution of conflict among primates. Fires start, but fires also go out, said von Waal. Obvious as this is, scientists concerned with aggression, a sort of social fire, have totally ignored the means by which the flames of aggression are extinguished. We know a great deal about the causes of hostile behavior in both animals and humans, yet we know little of the way conflicts are avoided, or how, when they do occur, relationships are afterward repaired and normalized. As a result, people tend to believe that violence is more integral to human nature than peace. Some 70 years prior to that epiphany, Gandhi had written in his classic Hind Swaraj that what we call history records the breakdowns of the even progress of nature, the evolution towards nonviolence, which, quote, being natural, is not recorded in history, unquote. In other words, the modern world has a myopic vision that sees only the shadow, the negative afterimage of reality. Therefore, it is hard to exaggerate the potential significance of these signs of emergence of nonviolence. Nonviolence is, for one thing, the bridge between spiritual development and social change. One who cherishes her or his spirituality and wants to help the world cannot do so through violence, which flatly contradicts spirituality. But the significance of this emergence is even greater. It's nothing less than an attempt of human nature to reassert itself against the conditioning of the industrial age. As Houston Smith said some years ago, quote, for our culture as a whole, nothing major is going to happen until we figure out who we are. We haven't a clue who we are today, end quote. This is because we have ignored what Gandhi said was nothing less than, quote, the law of our species, unquote, that is, nonviolence. In unearthing our capacity for nonviolence, a process that still has far to go, we are finding ourselves, as a species, beginning to realize the meaning of our existence. This process needs activists who are, as Joanna Macy says, stopping the worst of the damage. But it also needs all of us. Nonviolence in practice, aka love in action, is the outward manifestation of the, quote, new story, unquote. But in addition to direct action, and we will need more of it in the coming years, there are other dimensions to the mysterious process of paradigm shift. We facilitate it by acting it out and being vocal about why we're doing it. At the nonprofit where I work, the Meta Center for Nonviolence, we've developed a roadmap that the progressive movement can use to realize its full effectiveness in creating this cultural shift. The inner core of roadmap, called Person Power, offers 5 recommendations anyone is free to take up. 1. Avoid violent media, even if that means all commercial media today. 2. Learn everything you can about nonviolence to fill that cultural vacuum. 3. Take up a spiritual practice, if you haven't already done so. 4. Interact personally wherever possible to overcome our isolation, making ourselves invulnerable to oppression, for one thing. And 5. Tell the story. Never hesitate to explain that we are body, mind, and spirit. That security does not come from defeating enemies or fulfillment from buying things and destroying the planet in the process. We are at the most dangerous crisis of human existence because we have acquired the power to destroy ourselves and are still immature enough to actually do it. Wisdom alone can save us. That wisdom is certainly within us, and nonviolence and thought and action is the way to find it. For more information on the new science, check out Amos Winter 2014 at www.ipjc.org. Michael Naylor is Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, where he founded the Peace and Conflict Studies Program. He is also President of the Meta Center for Nonviolence and author of The Search for a Nonviolent Future, and most recently, The Nonviolence Handbook, A Guide to Practical Action.
Trading in Binding Fear for Love in Action by Ken Budigan. Many years ago, I served a 6-week jail sentence for engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience as part of a demonstration for peace and justice in Central America. On the day I arrived at the prison in the California desert, I was sent with the other new inmates to what was billed euphemistically as our orientation, but which amounted to a fire and brimstone sermon delivered by a sergeant at the top of his lungs. The guard's shrill and descriptive harangue was designed to instill a heavy enough dose of fear to keep us scrupulously in line. A few days later, as I was walking across the prison yard, I heard, "Hey, you!" It was the sergeant who had laid down the law. He ordered me to pick up trash out on the far edge of the property. Without a moment's hesitation, I double-timed it to the area overlooking the desert. After I had been picking up cigarette butts and gum wrappers for a while, a Jeep Cherokee slowly rumbled up the hill. When it pulled up next to me, the tinted windows on the driver's side slowly slid down. It was the sergeant. "What the hell are you doing here?" he yelled. "You told me to come out here and pick up garbage." My recently acquired fear of him rapidly deepened. I had learned from my cellmates that he relished fights breaking out between prisoners because he could then wade in among them and beat them. "Anything could happen here," I said to myself, "and would be my word against his." "No," he replied. "What are you doing in this prison?" I was caught off guard by his question. I protested the killing of my sisters and brothers in Nicaragua and El Salvador, I said. His face, already angry, grew even angrier. I thought he was going to go berserk. Suddenly, though, the anger melted away. He quickly looked both ways and said, almost in a whisper, "They sent me to Vietnam. I was ordered to kill a lot of people. Now I don't sleep much at night." He paused for a moment, and then he said, "If the government wants my kids for the next war, I'm driving them to Canada." Then he looked me straight in the eye and said, "What you did probably will make no difference, but I'm glad you did it." For what seemed like an eternity, the sergeant and I held each other's gaze. Then he abruptly shifted his eyes and barked, "Get the rest of this trash picked up." Rolling up the window, he drove off quickly. For years, this experience has served as a personal touchstone for the power of violence and our potential to transform it, and the role fear plays in both. Authority based on instilling fear, authority acquiesced in because of that fear. At the beginning, the typical scenario had played out the ways it unwinds in innumerable ways every day around the world. Then the script suddenly had gone awry. The prison guard's history of violence had been kept tightly intact by what we might call an energy field of fear. A military service record that haunted him, a job that depended both on generating fear and fending it off, and a fear that his own children might be dragged down by his government into war. Something that had happened to him, and that he deeply regretted. Now, for just a moment, the fear abated long enough for him to come clean, to reveal himself, and to do so not simply to a prisoner, which would have been unusual enough, but to a prisoner serving time for protesting war. This may have been the first time this sergeant has shared his experience of killing to anybody. How it had haunted him, how he wasn't able to sleep, and how he even entertained thoughts of resisting plans for a future war. As his fear evaporated long enough to unleash something of his deeper truth, I found my own fears slowly ebbing away. I was able to see this guard as a human being, and I began to wonder if this was why I had taken nonviolent action in the first place. To meet this wounded stranger, to experience a brief moment of communion and shared solace together, to receive such a revelation from this surprising quarter, and to share with him what the thinker Emmanuel Levinas called the flow of infinity between the eyes. All that this required was the miraculous gift of transforming fear, his and mine, into something unexpectedly powerful and liberating. Virtually all monumental crises we face today, war, poverty, climate change, racism, sexual assault, hunger, are crushing forms of violence. If by violence we mean any physical, verbal, emotional, institutional, or structural behavior, attitude, policy, or condition that disrespects, dominates, dehumanizes, diminishes or destroys ourselves, our fellow beings, or our world. Chronic violence is global, but it also seeps into our lives, relationships, workplaces, communities, and societies. It is fear that unleashes, justifies, and prolongs this violence. Even more, fear is the binding energy that consolidates and deepens violence. This binding energy can trap us as individuals, but it can also grip entire societies and fuel whole cultures of violence, including our own. But it need not be this way. In our freer moments, we realize that we are called in this time to build a world of peace, justice, and sustainability, a world free from pervasive personal, interpersonal, and structural violence, and that this will require many things, including contagiously transforming the fear that binds us. Here are a few suggestions for doing this. Give up our belief in fear and violence. Our culture of violence is held together by a belief system that says, as the late theologian Walker Wink put, violence saves. Wink's research shows that for at least 5,000 years, many of us have put our stock in the myth of redemptive violence, which turns out to be neither good myth nor good redemption. This story that violence is the answer ignores the underpinnings of that myth, the fear-based life and an unending cycle of violence. Try on a belief in goodness, connectedness, and nonviolence. Here is a concrete way to approach this. Regard anyone who crosses your path the way you regard the most beloved person in your life. Try this for a year or a month or maybe a week. Not only will it help us see the infinite worth of every being, it will begin to lessen the chronic fear we have been taught by our culture. It will also serve as a basis of nonviolence by nourishing our interior font of gratitude, compassion, and unconditional love. Finally, take action. Join with others to build a movement locally, nationally, or internationally to spread the power of nonviolent love and action. This will reveal your fears and how to respond to them. What action should you take? Write down the sentence, "If I were not afraid, I would." And then reflect a bit and fill in the blank. It will help you crystallize what you want to do and encourages you to take steps to it. Together, we can transform the cloying fear that renders us immobile and that keeps our culture of violence humming. Even more importantly, we can together build a culture of peace and nonviolence fearlessly. Ken Budigan is the executive director of Pace Bene Nonviolence Service and an organizer of Campaign Nonviolence. He also teaches part-time in the Peace, Justice, and Conflict Studies program at DePaul University in Chicago and writes a column for WagingNonviolence.org.
We Are Beloved by Nicholas Melle. As I write, the United States is angry, anxious, saddened, and split over the shooting of a young unarmed black man by a white policeman several months ago. At the same time, another younger black child has just been shot because he was at a playground with a toy gun which closely resembled a real weapon. We live in the midst of a stew of fear and violence. News outlets headline stories about scary epidemics, war, mass executions. Social media memes, cleverly chosen images and sayings propagated over the internet, cater to stereotypes, polarization, and fear. Popular culture promotes the myth that violence can solve almost any problem and protect individuals as well as nations from any threat. As theologian Walter Wink wrote in Engaging the Powers, "Violence is the ethos of our time. It is the spirituality of the modern world. It has been accorded the status of religion, demanding from its devotees an absolute obedience unto death. Violence and threat breeds fear, fear of others, fear for our safety, fear that we will not be able to stand against the threats screaming from headlines and television, news, and talk shows. To climb out of the morass of violence in which we live requires courage, creativity, effort, persistence, personal integrity, and a sense of humor. We must start by honestly examining and healing the violence within ourselves. The first step is cultivating awareness of how we have internalized the violence we experience daily and inflict it
on ourselves and others. The violence we experience is not confined to news headlines or fiery talk show panelists. We also hear threats and violence daily from our families, our friends, our teachers, our supervisors, and from our co-workers. The myth that violence solves problems, that a kind of purification or even redemption comes through violent behavior, dominates our attitudes and behavior. Over time, we internalize the messages of threat and violence and speak harshly to ourselves. To be sure, often the violent words we hear are not intended to threaten or induce fear. They are simply the consequence of the ethos of our time, described by Wink. For example, an exasperated parent seeking some support for house cleaning might say to his child, "Pick up your toys," in a tone of voice that the child hears as an implicit threat to withdraw love or impose punishment. Over time, we impose limits on ourselves in anticipation of others' disappointment, disapproval, or withdrawal. As we do so, we also strive to earn approval and love and to exceed what we think others expect of us. Popular culture reinforces feelings that we are not loved and or do not measure up. The same media that convey messages of violence and threat convey advertisements and subliminal messages that tell us we are each inadequate, but can compensate by purchasing the right products or can soothe our anxiety through self-indulgence. We often fall into this trap and substitute material goods for love or identity and value ourselves through our possessions. I drive a luxury car or an SUV or a sexy sports car. I wear brand X clothing. Popular culture also urges us to avoid relationships in which we feel secure, including relationships such as with poor or otherwise marginalized people that might draw disapproval from admirable or powerful people. We see the weakest members of society, the homeless, the mentally ill, the undocumented worker, as threats to be met with their bravado and force rather than as people desperately in need of compassion. Since we feel inadequate to deal with our fear, we automatically resort to violence instead of carefully considering responses proportional to the degree and probability of the threats we perceive. How, then, can we defeat the violence which envelops us? How can we live a fully nonviolent, fully human life, passionate and compassionate, stalwartly resisting evil and injustice? The gospel accounts of Jesus' life give us some guidance. All three synoptic gospels tell the story of Jesus' baptism. The story opens the Gospel of Mark. In all three, God declares, "You are my beloved Son." After this, Jesus retreats into the wilderness to fast and pray before beginning his ministry. Throughout his life, Jesus' trust in God's love freed him from shame, fear, and other emotional and social pressures. Thus, he was free to love others, in the process breaking through social constraints to heal and build community with outcasts, despised people like tax collectors, differently abled people, and even Roman soldiers. He saw beyond the letter of the Mosaic Law into its spirit and confronted those who could not or would not grasp the law as deeply. Jesus calls us repeatedly to this same sort of risk-taking and removal of barriers to community. The practice of contemplative prayer has opened the door to feeling beloved for many. The longer I sit quietly in the cloud of unknowing, the more aware I become of God's love. Whether we focus on our breath, recite a sacred word, or use any other technique, when we are still, we are open to God. We can also feel God's love more intensely when we practice gratitude. Simply recounting to ourselves a few people, situations, or things we are thankful for in our lives brings concrete evidence of God's love. Offering thanks to God fosters greater intimacy with God and a deeper knowledge of divine love. We can, moreover, acquire a sense of being loved when we are serving others in some way. When we care for the least of these, we honor their belovedness and our own. As members of the body of Christ, we too are God's beloved children. As described above, we find this difficult to know and feel, although we may give our intellectual assent to the idea that God loves us. Henry Nouwen was much concerned with this subject. He moved from a kind of academic but detached allegiance to the gospel through stages of engagement with others that culminated in his long participation in the life of the large community in Canada. These words, from a posthumously published talk by Nouwen, summed up the centrality of feeling God's love. We are not what we do. We are not what we have. We are not what others think of us. Coming home is claiming the truth. I am the beloved child of a loving Creator. Iconic leaders in nonviolent action also stress the value of feeling beloved. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. defined belovedness as an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. It is the love of God working in the lives of women and men. We can come to embrace God's love through various routes, but several steps are critical to free ourselves of the effects of our culture's ethos of violence. We might start by growing more aware of the violence directed at us by mass media, simply noticing the content of news reports, novels, films, and so on, and exploring how we feel as we see and hear such things. We should, at the same time, become more mindful of how the people around us replay what they see and hear, and how we and they often respond with either a flight or fight response. We should not neglect a careful look at the violence we do to ourselves. All of this can be painful, and it is hard work, so we need to be gentle with ourselves as well as aware, honest, and brave. Acknowledging emotions like fear, anger, and pain takes persistence and patience, yet allowing ourselves to experience these emotions helps dissipate them. A set of questions posed by Father John Deere in his recent book, The Nonviolent Life, offers a framework for examining the violence we and others do to ourselves from our personal experience and perspective. Start by looking at the violence within. What's going on inside you? How do you feel about yourself, your life, your body, your spirit, your soul? Do you ever speak critically or harshly to yourself? That is, "Oh, that was stupid." Do you have any areas or feelings of violence toward yourself? Because we live in a culture of violence, we all have moments of self-hatred or violence. Ponder your life journey. What violence did you experience from your parents, siblings, relatives, friends, classmates, neighbors. How was your childhood and youth influenced by the realities of violence? What violence did you experience? What violence did you internalize? Finally, consider how we can let the violence lingering within us go and move beyond it to new feelings of peace, inner freedom, and joy. Moving deeper into the understanding of being beloved, Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. spoke and wrote of the beloved community as the goal of nonviolent action. Joining with others to form a nonviolent community offers companionship and support for the profoundly different way of being and conducting ourselves that is the way of nonviolence. Many organizations, like Pax Christi, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and the Denominational Peace Fellowships, offer resources for small groups or individuals wishing to move deeper into nonviolence. In community, we can explore nonviolence with other support and together act to reduce and resist the violence in which our society immerses us. We can become prophets speaking the truth of our loving God and Jesus' way of nonviolence to a country addicted to violence. Since choosing nonviolence is profoundly countercultural in the United States today, we need to look for signs of hope while we explore the effects of violence. Throughout my lifelong journey into nonviolence, I have been inspired by an elderly Quaker training a group of college students in 1970. By witnessing unjust authoritarian states in South Africa, South Korea, and the Philippines transition peacefully to democracy, and by the growth and success of unarmed interveners in conflict zones around the world. Not every act of nonviolence succeeds, but as Cesar Chavez noted, there is no such thing as defeat in nonviolence. Nick Maley, the author, is a retired senior Foreign Service officer who writes on foreign affairs, nonviolence, and other justice issues for a variety of publications. He is currently a Washington State promoter for Campaign Nonviolence.
A Call to a Life of Nonviolence by Denny DeFell. Denny DeFell is a deacon living in Northeast Seattle and a member of Pax Christi. A matter of spirit, Amos asked him a few questions about his commitment to nonviolence. Amos, what encounters have led you to a nonviolent lifestyle? I was a short and scrappy kid, but a fight on asphalt when I threw another kid to the ground and knocked him out instantly replaced my anger with a dread that I had hurt someone seriously, and it changed my life. I still remember that day. I matured as a student in the late 60s, influenced by the civil rights struggle and the anti-war movement. I was raised Catholic, and my reflections on Jesus' life and teachings led me to reject war, war-making, and preparing for war. I sought and received conscientious objector status. Instead of serving as a soldier in Vietnam, I spent 4 years as a Jesuit volunteer, embracing practical poverty, living in community, and working to make a difference in the lives of the poor. Soon afterwards, I met and was deeply moved by Cesar Chavez and his nonviolent struggle for justice with its strong spiritual roots. I began to read seriously the writings of King, Merton, and Dorothy Day. In the late 70s and early 80s, my wife and I lived with the Seattle Catholic Worker Community and helped campaign against the Trident nuclear submarine base at Bangor. My day job was at an inner-city parish, first staffing a food bank and eventually learning neighborhood organizing. Of course, Archbishop Hunthausen was a terrific inspiration. His picture is still on my wall. Circumstances moved us from our parish and community, but the changes led to my current ministries at St. Bridget Church and Children's Hospital in Seattle, where I minister as a chaplain. This is a precious gift to my life, and the families have taught me much. One cannot work there without being moved to compassion. This work has taught me that building peace and holding the broken heart are very similar. When did you feel challenged in living nonviolently? Personally, traffic, child raising, and struggles within the family. Nonviolent child raising is one of the most important skills we can learn, but one not easy to master. But in our highly violent culture, what work could be more immediate and more important for the long haul than to teach our children how to respect others and solve problems together? Sure, it's difficult. My own children struggle daily with the challenges of raising our grandchildren, though they are surely more conscientious than I was. My wife Joan and the organization she heads, the Committee for Children, is a national leader in social and emotional learning for young children. Their second step program, Teaching Empathetic Listening, Problem Solving, and Impulse Control to the Very Young, is changing the world. Yet even for a program like this, in 25,000 schools, it's still one classroom and one child at a time. Each of us can make our individual difference. Peace begins in the human heart. Amos. What are the opportunities to nonviolence for all of us? Again, we can make a difference in the community around us, and it spreads from there. At 67 years, I'm still learning and searching. Last year, I took the vow of nonviolence with others as public witness, and we just renewed our commitment again in December. Why not seek out others to join you to take the pledge? Why don't we all make peacemaking more intentional? I found that taking this vow intensified my passion for peacebuilding. I find myself reading about nonviolence, talking with individuals and groups, writing letters, and looking for creative ways to raise my voice, yearning and praying for justice and peace. And yes, examining my own heart and relationships, and looking to join with others in nonviolent movements for justice. I know I'm just one guy, but I believe people all over yearn for this. Don't you?
Ending the Spiral of Violence by Anna Patrice Clark. The last 4 years gave birth to a new generation of uprisings, from Tunisia to Egypt, Mexico to Mali, Hong Kong to Burkina Faso, to U.S. streets with Ferguson, a fervor for justice enkindled social movements in more than 50 countries. People around the world are rising up and demanding justice and freedom. But how is that goal achieved, violently or nonviolently? Violent insurrections often repeat themselves with massive bloodshed. Violence spirals endlessly into ever harsher responses. But it doesn't need to do so. We can end the spiral with the power of nonviolence. Dom Helder Gamara, an archbishop in Brazil during its military dictatorship, describes the three-part violent path in his Spiral of Violence. The originating violence, he says, is injustice. You will find that everywhere, the injustices are the basic violence. When people's rights are suppressed in high unemployment rates, unjust wage disparities, rising costs of living, censorship, and denied civic freedoms, it is violence. People grow unwilling to accept the injustices they've been forced to endure. They rebel, demanding rights and dignity. Revolt is the second violence. When oppressors see their power challenged, they respond with force. Gamara calls this the third violence, repression. When we use violence to show that violence is wrong, we act discordantly, and oppressors maintain moral justification to continue. Repression creates more injustices, which lead to uprisings. The spiral continues, with each iteration more deeply entrenching the pattern. This is the spiral of violence. Martin Luther King Jr. described this phenomenon poetically. The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Through violence you may murder the hater, but you do not murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Overall, violence dehumanizes. A person trained to hate or kill another no longer sees a human, but rather an object. Yet, there is another way. We hold the power to end this descending spiral. When we choose nonviolence, we choose love. We decide to see our enemy as a human being and refuse to give in to the dehumanizing cycle. Some may call nonviolence cowardice, but it requires great courage to acknowledge that restoring the humanity of your attacker is more important than revenge. It is also successful. A study by Maria Stefan and Erica Chenoweth of 323 conflicts in the 20th century shows nonviolent uprisings were twice as successful as violent ones. Gandhi reflected, "Power is of two kinds. One is obtained by the fear of punishment, and the other by acts of love. Power based on love is 1,000 times more effective and permanent than the one derived from fear and punishment. Repressive governments retain control through fear of punishment, often very brutal punishment. It takes time and effort to get over that fear, but once we do, the power of love is immensely stronger and more resilient. When we participate in boycotts, marches, protests, vigils, letter writing, get to know our enemies, or bring gifts to those trying to hurt us, we practice courageous love in the face of fear. We proclaim the greatest force in the world is the deepest truth. Each human being has value." As Srdja Popovic, a leader of the Serbian Revolution, now making nonviolence his life's work, says, quote, "Ultimately, power in society comes from the obedience of the people. And those people, each of whom is individually a small source of power, can change their minds and refuse to follow commands." Unquote. Nonviolence reminds people that they have power simply through being human. Nonviolence rehumanizes in three ways: our enemy to us to ourselves, and us to our enemy. When we communicate with people who are different from us, we become more able to see their perspective and can then better address their and our fears and biases. While in jail for rebellious acts, Bassem Araman, a Palestinian, watched a movie about the Holocaust. He remembered, quote, "I tried to hide my tears from the other prisoners who wouldn't have understood why I was crying about the pain of my oppressors," unquote. He started talking with his Israeli guard. Eventually, friendship replaced the animosity between the two. We also humanize ourselves to ourselves. Years of oppression and messages of worthlessness can be internalized as self-dehumanization. We cannot, however, make others see our humanity when we cannot see it ourselves. Remaining nonviolent in the face of force requires courage and a strong belief that we are fully worthy of receiving justice and dignity. Furthermore, we humanize ourselves to our opponents. Boycotts, strikes, marches, and comedic skits show people who support the oppressor that the resistance is made up of individuals with wants, needs, and personalities. When the enemy, quote-unquote, knows our name, holds our children, shares a meal with us, and understands our point of view, ideologies begin to shift. People can no longer rationalize using force against someone they understand. Defections happen in practically every revolution, whether by just a few individuals or nearly the entire military, such as in the color revolutions of Serbia, Ukraine, and Georgia. When we choose to humanize, the spiral stops. Governments are toppled, but more important, hearts are changed. Imagine what would be possible if we each found creative ways to challenge power structures, show people their power, humanize each other, and encourage the defection of supporters on important issues. For instance, the U.S. has not been this politically polarized since the Civil War. How can we rehumanize each other, not as enemies, but as people in the system? These methods can be used in our households, communities, and jobs, in companies and governments. We can each do something with our power to end the spiral of violence and create a better, more just world. Our time is full of violence in Central America, Syria, Sudan, and more. Yet we remember that hope is not lost. Martin Luther King Jr. concludes his earlier statement, quote, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." We can choose nonviolence. We can choose love. Nonviolence in Colombia by Julia Durante. Julia Durante has worked with the Witness for Peace Colombia International Team for 2 years. Buenaventura, the city of Colombia's largest port, is often described by its extremes. The unemployment, 50%, poverty, 80%, forced displacement, disproportionately high even in a country with the world's second largest internally displaced population. Buenaventura is home to more than 400,000 people, mostly Afro-Colombians, whose ancestors developed a culture in harmony with the ocean. But powerful economic interests battling for port control turned Buenaventura into one of Colombia's most violent cities. Paramilitary groups enabled by corrupt politicians have established a brutal rule, using extortion, torture, and murder to terrify residents into silence. In April 2014, the community of La Playita, an oceanfront neighborhood impacted by port expansion and illegal armed groups, took a stand against fear and violence. Accompanied by Colombian organizations and international NGOs like Witness for Peace, the community established Colombia's first urban humanitarian space called Puente Nayero. The space was inaugurated with popular education workshops, music and dance, acts that celebrated life over death and peace over violence, and an assembly in which 800 families committed to participating in a space governed by nonviolence and free of illegal armed actors. Since then, Puente Naero and its leaders have been threatened by local paramilitaries, but the space's continued existence is a testament to the strength of the community's commitment to nonviolent organizing, as well as how national and international accompaniers with nonviolence as their mandate help elevate the community's profile to raise the political cost of violence against it. Walking with Puente Naero as they reclaim a space for life, build community within it, and assert their political power outside it has been an incredible privilege. It reinforces the importance of Witness for Peace's mission of physical accompaniment in forming popular education, which in turn elevates international attention and action in solidarity with the nonviolent struggles of those seeking justice throughout Latin America.
Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, by Lucy McBath. It was 2 years ago last month that I found myself on a path I did not choose, fighting a battle I did not start, advocating to change dangerous gun laws I never knew existed. My son Jordan, just 17 years old, was shot and killed by an armed man in Florida in a dispute over loud music. Jordan was unarmed and seated in the back seat of his friend's car when the man opened fire, ripping him of his young life and me of my only child. I knew after this experience that God was calling me for a higher purpose, to help prevent others from undergoing the unspeakable pain of losing loved ones in such a senseless way. Today, I serve as spokesperson for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, a grassroots movement of moms founded the day after the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary that took the lives of 20 first graders and 6 educators. The movement was started by a mom on a Facebook page and has since become a part of the largest gun violence prevention organization in the country, Every Town for Gun Safety, with more than 2.5 million members and a mom's chapter in every state. Since its inception just 2 years ago, Moms Demand Action has been at the forefront of this movement, fighting for public safety measures that respect the rights of citizens yet protect people from gun violence. Our moms and supporters know there are solutions to curb the gun violence epidemic in America, and we are working every day to do just that. Since the tragedy at Sandy Hook, not a single law has been passed at the federal level to prevent gun violence. If Congress won't protect our children and families, moms will. We launched a corporate responsibility campaign to insist that American businesses enact policies that will protect our families when we patronize them. And succeed we have. In just 1 year, moms have convinced retailers and restaurants to end the practice open carry in their establishments, a practice that is largely unregulated in most states, meaning no training, permitting, or background checks are required. Starbucks, Target, Panera, Chipotle, Sonic Drive-In, and Chili's are among the businesses that have chosen to enact smart gun policies. Another way we are driving change is by fighting for common sense gun laws at the state level, like closing the dangerous background check loophole on gun purchases. In this last midterm election, voters in Washington State took to the polls on a ballot initiative to close these loopholes and expand background checks for all gun sales. Gun safety won by an impressive majority, and we expect other states with ballot initiatives to follow suit in coming elections. Over the summer, more than a million Americans took our Gun Sense Voter Pledge, committing to vote for candidates who support common sense gun laws, and our supporters made thousands of phone calls encouraging voters to head to the polls. On election night, we saw the candidates who had publicly supported and enacted common sense gun laws elected. I, and so many Americans across this great country, are empowered by the stories of success we have in building a community of advocates demanding not one more life be lost to senseless gun violence. I call on the faith community to join us in pushing for change and to provide support to those whose lives have been so tragically impacted by gun violence. We hold the future of God's children in our hands. Let's do everything we can to help make it a blessed one. Together, we will reverse this epidemic, one family, one law, one company, and one election at a time. Lucy McBath is the mother of Jordan Davis and a national spokesperson for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America.
A Matter of Spirit is a publication of the Intercommunity Peace and Justice Center. Sponsoring communities include Adrian Dominican Sisters, Congregation of Sisters of St. Joseph of Peace, Oregon Province Jesuits, Sisters of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary, U.S. Ontario Province, Sisters of Providence, Mother Joseph Province, Sisters of St. Francis of Philadelphia, and the Tacoma Dominicans. Affiliate communities include Benedictine Sisters of Cottonwood, Idaho, Benedictine Sisters of Lacey, Benedictine Sisters of Mount Angel, Dominican Sisters of San Rafael, Cincinnati Dominicans, Sisters of Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, Sisters of St. Mary of Oregon, Society of the Holy Child Jesus, Society of the Sacred Heart, and the Ursuline Sisters of the Roman Union. Our editorial board for this issue was Timnit Germe, Gretchen Gundrum, Linda Haydock, Vince Herberholt, Tom Hulscher, and Nick Mealy. Our editor is Anna Patrice Clark, and the layout of the print edition was done by Justin Almeida. The audio version was read by Pat Higgins, Catherine Ranzel, and Bob Failey. For more information, visit our website at www.ipjc.org.